From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today we remember novelist E.L. Doctorow, who died this week at the age of 84. His award-winning and popular novels included Billy Bathgate, Ragtime, and The March. Many featured fiction and nonfiction characters together in historical settings.
In the case of historically verifiable characters, I'm dealing with the fictions they themselves made of their lives, the extent that they made themselves public and promulgated a myth about themselves, as Dutch Schultz did, as J.P. Morgan did, as Emma Goldman did.
And we remember journalist Marlene Sanders, who died earlier this month. She was one of the first women to break into TV news. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz tells us about his renewed appreciation for the New York City Ballet, and film critic David Edelstein reviews the new film Phoenix. That's coming up on Fresh Air. Writer E.L. Doctorow died Tuesday in Manhattan at the age of 84. His novels were known for combining fictional characters with real people in a historical context. In his best-known book, Ragtime, Freud, Emma Goldman, Henry Ford, and Harry Houdini all make appearances. Dutch Schultz is one of the main characters in Doctorow's novel Billy Bathgate. His novel World's Fair was set during the Depression and the rise of Hitler. The March, his book about Sherman's campaign in the Civil War, won the William Penn Faulkner Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award for fiction. Many of Doctorow's novels were adapted to the screen, and Ragtime, the book that made him famous, also became a Broadway musical that won 4 Tony Awards. Terry spoke to E.L. Doctorow in 1989, when Billy Bathgate was published. The book is set in New York in 1935, where Billy, a teenager, works for the gangster Dutch Schultz. Billy Bathgate was made into a film in 1991, with Dustin Hoffman playing Schultz. Terry began by asking Doctorow to read the opening of the novel.
Okay, the very first sentence I wrote in Billy Bathgate is the first sentence that appears in the book, and it actually delivered the character of Billy to me. He was sort of built into the diction and the syntax, and even the rhythm of the sentence gave me the way he breathed. Billy is a 15-year-old boy in the Bronx in the 1930s who attaches himself to the great Dutch Schultz, the Prohibition and post-Prohibition New York gangster killer. And the book opens with Billy leaping aboard a tugboat where Mr. Schultz is taking one of his henchmen, Bo Weinberg, en route to a ritual drowning in New York Harbor. And this is the way the book begins. He had to have planned it because when we drove onto the dock, the boat was there and the engine was running, and you could see the water churning up phosphorescence in the river, which was the only light there was because there was no moon nor no electric light either in the shack where the dockmaster should have been sitting, nor on the boat itself, and certainly not from the car. Yet everyone knew where everything was, and when the big Packard came down the ramp, Mickey the driver braked it so that the wheels hardly rattled the boards. And when he pulled up alongside the gangway, the doors were already open, and they hustled Bo and the girl upside before they even made a shadow in all that darkness. And there was no resistance. I saw a movement of black bulk, that was all. And all I heard was maybe the sound someone makes who is frightened and has a hand not his own over his mouth. The doors slammed and the car was humming and gone, and the boat was already opening up water between itself and the slip before a thin minute had passed. Nobody said not to, so I jumped aboard and stood at the rail, frightened as you might expect, but a capable boy, he had said that himself. A capable boy, capable of learning, and I see now, capable of adoring, worshipping, that rudeness of power of which he was a greater student than anybody. Oh, and that menace of him where it might be all over for anyone in his sight from one instant to the next.
And that's E.L. Doctorow reading from his new novel, Billy Bathgate. Now, you said the voice came to you with that first sentence. And when I opened your book, the first thing I thought was how different this voice was from the usual staccato, hard-boiled style associated with crime writing and, you know, with gangster figures in American fiction.
Well, I don't think of this as crime writing, and I've never been a particularly fond of the so-called hard-boiled school of work. I've never been that much interested in crime fiction or true crime, nor have I followed the culture of professional criminals in the papers. I think of this as the story of a young man's sentimental education. It's a kind of Bildungsroman. He's a bright, enterprising kid, the ideal. He's curious, he's energetic, he has a lot of wonder for the world. It's just that it's the underworld that he's attached to. Of course, in those days, criminals were very much more compartmentalized than they are now. They had their place. They killed each other, and not you. If you just stayed out of their way and you didn't try to compete with them, you were relatively safe and could observe their comings and goings and drownings and killings with some impunity. Now there's some question, some blurring of those lines, I think. It's not quite as clear today in the 1980s who is exactly criminal and who isn't. We've had occasions of public officials who've been supposed or sworn to uphold the law who have in fact broken it. And all that kind of thing just leaches it away. It gives you almost a wish for the good old days when a crook was a crook and everyone else wasn't.
Why did you choose Dutch Schultz as the gangster that the main character in your novel apprentices himself to?
That's an interesting question. I think because he was a New York criminal, and I felt a little more comfortable with him. He was also has a more mythical presence in my mind than some of the others. Dutch Schultz was not his real name, you know. His real name was Arthur Fliegenheimer. But he took the name Dutch Schultz because he was such a tough kid. It was almost given to him as an honor by his gang because he got through reform school in such a feisty way. So he took on the name Dutch Schultz, which was the name of an earlier criminal in the turn of the century. And the name stuck. He later came to regret it, saying that if he'd kept with his original name, he wouldn't have gotten as much attention and therefore into as much difficulty, but that the name Dutch Schultz fit the headlines as the name Arthur Fliegenheimer couldn't. And so that was his error.
Was he Jewish?
He was.
Did that figure into your selecting him as the main gangster?
No, I don't think so. I think it may have been something as simple as that I liked the sound of the name, the sound Dutch Schultz. It had a kind of a primeval ring in my mind, I think.
Were there stories about him in the Bronx neighborhood where you grew up, or was he reputed to own any businesses or have any front operations there?
Well, Billy is seen early in the book when he goes back to tell about his first connection with Schultz, hanging around one of Dutch Schultz's beer drops, a place, a sort of a warehouse for the awful green beer he was selling or foisting on the speakeasies and then on the bars after the repeal of Prohibition. And the fact that the beer drop is in the neighborhood confers upon the neighborhood a certain kind of distinction, which the young boys like. It gives them a sense of place, a sense of bearing or position in the world that they might not otherwise have. I myself was only 4 years old when Dutch Schultz died. He was killed in 1935, and I don't think any of that actually came through to me. But obviously the name Dutch Schultz and general idea of his rather fast, meteoric, and violent career was part of the folklore of New York in the 1930s.
E.L. Doctorow is my guest, and we're talking about his new novel, Billy Bathgate. One of the central incidents of the new novel is a ritual murder in which one of Schultz's henchmen is killed by getting cement overshoes and getting drowned in the ocean. And you write, a ritual death tampers with the universe. I think this idea of the ritual death was something of great interest to you in planning this novel?
Well, it certainly, the book began with an image in my mind of men in tuxedos in black tie on a tugboat. And for the longest time, I didn't know what it meant or why I was thinking of it. And then I realized that they had to be criminals and that one of them was going to kill the other. And that's really the genesis of the entire book. That's the way it began for me. So this was a crucial scene, very seminal scene, and the nature of the ritual, the sort of sad necessity of it sort of seeps through the entire occasion and makes it quite horrifying. And I guess something about that appealed to me as a writer.
Let me ask you to read another short excerpt from Billy Bathgate. And this is Billy talking about what it feels like to hold a gun for the first time.
Yes, this comes later. He begins as a insinuates himself into the gang, attaches himself to Dutch Schultz, gets his attention, and then becomes kind of mascot, good luck charm, and gradually works his way up into sort of an apprentice kind of person in the gang, and goes beyond that later. But at this point, they're up in the country, and he's given instruction in the firing of a gun, taken to a local police firing range where Dutch Schultz and his men have set up firing privileges. And Billy says in this point, I will never forget how it felt to hold a loaded gun for the first time and lift it and fire it. The scare of its animate kick up the bone of your arm. You're empowered. There's no question about it. It's an investiture like knighthood. And even though you didn't invent it or design it or tool it, the credit is yours because it's in your hand. You don't even have to know how it works. The credit is all yours. With the slightest squeeze of your finger, a hole appears in a piece of paper 60 feet away. And how can you not be impressed with yourself? How can you not love this coiled and sprung causation? I was awed. I was thrilled. The thing is, guns come alive when you fire them. They move. I hadn't realized that.
Did you go to a shooting range or anything before writing this and hold a gun in your hand so you have a sense of the physical sensation you were trying to describe?
No. No, I don't. I've never fired a pistol. As a soldier in the army, I fired rifles, which do have a kick. I sort of a different kind. But this, the thing about writing is that that you use your imagination a good deal of the time and can usually work out things by thinking about them and imagining them. That's the whole game, to get into people's skins, to pretend to be someone you're not, to have experiences you've never had, and to represent them truly, to render them so that questions like this are asked of you.
Several critics who loved your new novel mentioned that in the first person narrative of Billy, who's 15 or 16 in the novel, that he uses some words that it's kind of hard to believe he'd have access to, words like empowered and investiture, which were in the reading that you just gave. How did you think that through, about what kind of language to give him, especially with these like bigger words and more?
Well, I must have understood he was smart as a whip. He's a something of a rhapsodist, too. I mean, part of his being is his power to celebrate that, even things even that repel him and make him fearful. He seems to take all of life into himself and embrace it, with a capacity for wonder and rhapsody that is reflected in these nice looping long sentences he comes up with. We do learn at the certain crucial strategic point that Billy has used his criminal earnings to get himself through a very advanced high school in New York called Townsend Harris High School, and then into an Ivy League college, which he decides not to name, because in his adulthood, when he's writing this book, he has a certain renown, and he doesn't want to be identified. He's rather mysterious, as it turns out. And possibly as an alumnus of whatever Ivy League college it is, he doesn't want to pin the rap on them.
Billy Bathgate continues in the tradition, if you'll pardon that word, that you've established in your novels of combining fictional and real historical figures. What is the resonance that you think you can get from a novel by combining those two together?
Well, I don't really know. It's just something that sort of happened. I didn't begin with any aesthetic theory. I think I've since been forced to try to describe or defend this practice many times. I think what I'm doing is dealing with in the case of historically verifiable characters, is I'm dealing with the fictions they themselves made of their lives, the extent that they made themselves public and promulgated a myth about themselves, as Dutch Schultz did, as J.P. Morgan did, as Emma Goldman did in Ragtime. You begin with the fictions people create about themselves, and then they're in your realm, you see. And it's quite valid for you to deal with them and take off from that point.
You know, it's the kind of thing you probably see done badly a lot. You know, even on miniseries, figures from the past are combined with fictional characters, and you end up with a kind of hodgepodge of history. Do you ever feel that people who do this kind of thing less well point to you as a defense for what they're practicing?
Well, I suppose all's fair in love and art. I mean, I don't feel I have to defend the miniseries.
Uh-huh.
I also know that novelists have been doing this forever. I mean, Napoleon is in War and Peace. Dumas, a great favorite of mine as a boy, the Cardinal Richelieu is a character in, what is it, Count of Monte Cristo, The Three Musketeers. I mean, it seems to me the justification for any work is not what theory it uses, but how good the particular book is. I do know that when Ragtime first came out, a lot of people said, well, he can't do this, it's not allowable. Yet writers now sort of routinely base novels on factual, historically verifiable figures. Nobody says a thing about it. So maybe this idea of the strict demarcation between the fictional and the non-fictional is breaking down a little bit, which is probably all to the good, because we all compose our lives every day, every minute of the waking and sleeping, and I don't think that fiction writers should be the only ones to take the rap for that.
You are still a board member of PEN, the International Writers Organization?
Yes, I am.
Why has it been important for you? You've been outspoken on First Amendment issues in this country and on free speech issues in on behalf of writers in other countries as well. Why has that been important to you?
Well, I mean, what is the alternative? The alternative is repression and tyranny and the absence of thought, the absence of life. I think that any writer has to decide at a certain point to commit a certain amount of his time, his effort to this very basic, elementary insistence that such and such a writer shouldn't be in prison, and such a writer should be allowed back to his own country. Such and such a writer shouldn't be tortured, and certainly not have to be in hiding with a death threat on his head. We see all forms of censorship everywhere, all around the world. It's really quite appalling, and people who live by the word seem to me to have a certain obligation to simply point this out and say it's wrong.
Have you ever been afraid to speak or write your own truth?
You're always afraid. I mean, fear is one of the things you have to deal with. The fear of revelation, the fear of self-exposure, the fear of talking out of turn, the fear of offending those around you who may see themselves in your work. These are all the conditions you begin with, and part of becoming a writer is learning to deal with that fear, learning courage, learning the peculiar life of self-revelation.
There's the fear of embarrassment, you know, that you'll write something that won't be liked or that will reveal something about yourself that you won't want revealed, and then the fear of imprisonment, torture, or death. Do you think it's given writers more courage to watch writers in other countries who have to brave so much to just write what it is that they're writing?
Well, we are very privileged here, of course. Usually we're not physically in danger.
Well, actually, weren't you one of the writers who was monitored by the FBI back in the 70s?
Oh, yes, but that was a great honor, you see. That to have a file in the FBI is one of the credentials for achievement. It's like the honor roll of American writing. But essentially, nothing comes of that. But it's a great privilege to be on the same list with everyone from Theodore Dreiser and Faulkner and Hemingway and Catherine Ann Porter to all the way up to Truman Capote. I mean, it's a wonderful group of names to be attached to. It's kind of literary criticism the FBI does.
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
E.L. Doctorow speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. Doctorow died Tuesday in Manhattan. He was 84. After a break, we'll remember Marlene Sanders, a pioneer for women in broadcast journalism, and David Edelstein reviews the new film Phoenix. Here's music from Randy Newman's score for the film Ragtime. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another NPR podcast about pop culture you might want to check out. Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. He interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and others about their work and their lives.
For many years, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says he was addicted to and mesmerized by George Balanchine and the New York City Ballet. Then Lloyd lost interest. Lately, he says, his fascination has returned.
When I was a student in New York in the 1960s, the New York City Ballet was the institution dearest to me. At first, I was just thrilled by what I was seeing. I had no real understanding of George Balanchine or how important he was. But I learned quickly. Balanchine was our Shakespeare, actively creating a new repertoire that encompassed the comic and the tragic, the narrative and the abstract, and right in my hometown. No one has ever visualized music more deeply. Watching a Balanchine ballet is like watching music come alive. I especially loved going to Saratoga, the outdoor summer home of the City Ballet in upstate New York, where anyone could actually watch Balanchine himself rehearsing the company, strictly off limits at Lincoln Center. After Balanchine died in 1983, his spirit seemed to evaporate. And after the retirement of my favorite dance partners, the magnificent Suzanne Farrell and Peter Martins, who became the director of the company and fired Farrell from her coaching position, I stopped going, content to settle for Balanchine on videos made under the master's supervision. Lately, I've been fascinated by the cornucopia of new DVD releases on VAI, Video Artists International, which has tapes of New York City Ballet appearances on Canadian television, some with legendary dancers from before my time. Maria Tallchief, the first Native American ballet superstar, one of Balanchine's four wives, and the heartbreaking Tanaquil LeClaire, Balanchine's last wife, who was stricken with polio. On Volume 4, there's a charming 3-minute video in which Balanchine presents his dancers and even dances a little with them. Last summer at the Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival in the Berkshires, I saw a program featuring younger stars of the City Ballet, and I was blown away by the grace and musicality of ballerinas Tyler Peck and Teresa Reichlin, along with the powerful and elegant Tyler Angle and Robert Fairchild, who's now starring on Broadway in An American in Paris. Not just technically brilliant, these are artists with real personality. And on last year's Kennedy Center Honors, when Tyler Peck danced Gershwin's Fascinating Rhythm as part of a tribute to City Ballet's Patricia McBride, I suddenly had to see the company again. So this summer in Saratoga, I attended a matinee that featured two of Balanchine's very greatest works. One was The Four Temperaments, to music by Paul Hindemith that Balanchine himself commissioned, a work that was on the inaugural program of Ballet Society in 1946, the first incarnation of the New York City Ballet. You can see an excellent later performance on a VAI disc. It's like a vision of the inner workings of the cosmos. It starts with a couple, each extending one leg to a perfect point. Then suddenly they flex their ankles into a right angle, a no-no in classical ballet. But Balanchine makes this awkward gesture expressive and witty, surprisingly beautiful. He opens up a whole new world of dance, just as cubism transformed art. I also saw Symphony in C, the grand finale of the opening night of the officially renamed New York City Ballet in 1948. The irresistible music is by the 17-year-old Georges Bizet. The Saratoga performance featured sparkling Tyler Peck in the first movement and otherworldly Sarah Mearns in the breathtaking Adagio, where to a ravishing oboe solo, the ballerina falls or floats backwards in slow motion into the arms of her partner. These extraordinary dancers have breathed new life into Balanchine's legacy. And suddenly, once again, as in the old days, I want to follow what they're up to.
Lloyd Schwartz teaches in the Creative Writing MFA program at the University of Massachusetts Boston and is senior editor of classical music for the web journal New York Arts. He reviewed the New York City Ballet at the Saratoga Performing Arts Center and a series of five New York City Ballet in Montreal DVDs on VAI. Marlene Sanders, a pioneer for women in broadcast news, died earlier this month at the age of 84. She never became a network star, but she managed to do serious reporting, filing dispatches from Vietnam in the 60s, and eventually became a vice president at ABC News. Sanders is also the mother of CNN and New Yorker legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin. In his article, My Mom, Top Journalist, he wrote that she made her name covering the glory days of the women's movement, but continued to confront appalling sexism at many stages of her career. Sanders tried acting early in her 20s, then met a regional theater producer named Mike Wallace, and went on to work as a junior producer for his news programs. She was hired by ABC in 1964, hosting a five-minute broadcast called News with the Woman's Touch. She went to Vietnam in 1966 and later covered the assassination of Robert Kennedy and the riots during the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. She eventually made it into the executive ranks at ABC. In 1978, she moved to CBS and returned to reporting. Here she is on a CBS Newsbreak.
Good evening. From CBS News, this is Newsbreak. Soviet President Brezhnev told 12 U.S. senators that the Soviet Union had once tested a neutron bomb, but never put it into production. That's the bomb that kills people but leaves buildings standing. William Campilas, a 23-year-old former CIA employee, has been convicted of selling top-secret government documents to the Russians. Winter moved in on the Midwest today, 11 inches of snow in Minnesota. Also hard hit parts of Michigan and Wisconsin. It was some 9 months ago when the blizzard of 78 hit New England, and the medical community predicted this would be a busy time for maternity wards, but it hasn't happened. One nurse said most of the men must have been out shoveling snow. I'm Marlene Sanders, CBS News, New York. More news later.
Terry spoke to Marlene Sanders in 1988 when she'd co-written a book about the experiences of women in journalism called Waiting for Primetime. In 1964, Sanders made broadcast history when she was the first woman to anchor a network evening newscast. Terry asked how she was chosen to fill in when Ron Cochran suddenly lost his voice.
Well, I was the one that did the news in the afternoon. He was the one that did it at night. And the man who was the vice president of news, Jesse Zausmer, who was a great supporter of mine, he thought I was good and all that. And I don't know how they decided. They called and said, can you substitute for Cochran tonight? He lost his voice. And I had about 3 hours to, yeah, sir. Yes, I said, certainly. And I ran home and figured out what I should wear. And I came back and I just did it.
What kind of notice did it get, either in the press or from viewers? Was there a lot of attention paid to the fact that this was a woman anchoring an evening newscast?
Well, the New York Times wrote it up as a first. Jack Gould, who was a television critic, I can remember that review almost verbatim. He called me a courageous young woman with a Vassar smile, who had a no-nonsense manner, which is always the way I've done the news. And there was that. There was no bad response. But on the other hand, nothing else happened. I went back to the afternoon and to the stories I usually did. And it wasn't, nobody said, great, a breakthrough for women. It's a good idea. Let's do it. So nothing happened.
In 1970, you did a documentary called Women's Liberation on the women's movement. This was for ABC. And you say in your book that you didn't like the way the men reporters were covering the women's movement. What did you think was wrong with their coverage?
Well, they didn't understand it. I mean, they literally didn't understand it. They thought it had something to do with chivalry. And that everybody hated, the women involved were hated men. That it had to do with do you open the door for someone, do you light the cigarette, all this nonsense. And they really were putting it down. And I knew, of course, it was about equal opportunity, jobs, all of that kind of thing. So I went to the head of the documentary unit and I said, listen, I'd really like to do a half hour on what this is all about. And he was a very intelligent, good person. He said, go do it, which I did. And then I did a number of them afterwards.
But you were surprised that you encountered a degree of distrust among the feminists who you were covering.
Well, because there were a lot of factions in the feminist movement. And for one thing, they suspected me because I worked for the media that was the enemy in many respects, and how could I really understand if I worked for these people? And so I had a lot of hassles, not only with the management in getting to do these things, but actually some of the women involved. So that made it, interesting and a challenge.
Feminism had its effect within the networks as well. There was a lot of organizing going on in the 70s inside the networks for equal pay for women and for other women's rights. You founded, co-founded a group called the Women's Action Committee at ABC. And I guess I'm thinking about how hard it must be in a very, very competitive field like broadcasting to have a sense of solidarity with people who you're working with when you're also competing for the limited number of good jobs.
Well, the interesting thing about that was that at that time there were almost no women in news. I was one of the few. The rest were from public relations. They were at the corporate end. We didn't even know each other. I was not competitive with any of these people. We were all women from very different kinds of jobs who had looked at the women of the magazines, Time, Life, Newsweek, Fortune, all AP. There were all sorts of activities going on, and somehow we all found each other, got going, and got it started. Now, 10 years later at ABC, there now exists a group of all newswomen, and that means producers, writers, correspondents. They could have a whole group of newswomen. Well, I couldn't have had a group of newswomen. That would have been a group of two, maybe. So we were not competitive. We were wonderfully supportive of each other, and it was a terrific feeling at that time.
What do you think were the greatest gains that you got from organizing?
Well, first of all, making the managements aware of their bad record and the fact that women were kept out of certain jobs. What I think is the permanent accomplishment is that the doors are open at the, from the very bottom almost to the top. In other words, women can get into the pipeline. They can be not only desk assistants, but tape editors and members of camera crews and reporters and producers and a few in management. That still remains to be solved, that particular area. But every, you know, all the networks now have a lot of women in a great variety of jobs, and that was not happening not too many years ago.
For a while, you anchored the CBS Newsbreak, which is a short, minute-long newscast?
About that.
In prime time, in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my reaction the first time I saw you doing a newsbreak. I was like, gee, a real woman. I mean, I was used to seeing women anchoring, but mostly on the local level, and frequently the women were chosen, it seems, as much for their looks as for journalistic skills. And you just struck me as a real person, a real skilled person, as opposed to someone who was hired for being young and attractive. And it was very exciting for me.
Well, I've heard that from other people, and it really makes me feel good, too, because it's a peculiar skill to reduce the news of the world to, 10-second stories.
Right.
And also, it was live, and it was in front of 30, 40 million people. And I felt that, it had some symbolic benefit. So I'm happy to hear that your reaction was what I would have hoped.
Do you know why you lost the Newsbreak spot?
Well, actually, what happened was I was doing Sunday morning and a lot of other things when they had the cutbacks of a year and a half ago, and they asked me to move to radio full-time, basically doing hourly newscasts, which I had also been doing. No, I don't know. I don't know whether they just... I think what this is all about is that they wanted to feature in major spots their designated stars. That why bother with somebody like me, who's a good reporter and all that, but not anybody that was going to be on the Rather News, not anybody who was on their A team rather than the B team. So I think that was probably part of the decision. Ironically, shortly afterwards, they canceled Newsbreaks altogether. They don't do them anymore.
I want to read the way that you end your new book, and I'll preface this by saying that you left the CBS network when you agreed mutually to terminate your contract. You end your new book by saying, "To all who choose to meet the challenge, one final word, do not mistake a job for home and family or a trusted friend. It cannot be counted on. It can turn you out in an instant. However you decide to live your life, it is important to have personal involvements separate from your profession that will sustain you when, for whatever reason, your work comes to an end." Is that advice you took yourself when you were at the network?
That's advice I took all of my professional life. I was very fortunate. I had a long marriage. My husband died nearly 5 years ago, but I also raised a son who is a very accomplished young lawyer working on the Iran-Contra investigation. I had a personal life. I had a family. And believe me, I had a lot of ups and downs in my career, and that was very important. I think it is vital. Now, not everybody is going to get married in this world, but there are other ways you can have relationships and have other interests. It's just the kind of business that consumes you. People become workaholics. It's a very demanding and interesting life. But I saw people who were fired a year and a half ago who had spent their entire careers at CBS. They were single women. It was their home. It was their family. And they were devastated. Terribly, terribly sad.
Okay. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Terry spoke to Marlene Sanders in 1988. Sanders died earlier this month. She was 84.
Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another NPR podcast about pop culture you might want to check out. Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. He interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and others about their work and their lives.
The German director Christian Petzold won the Berlin Film Festival's top prize, the Silver Bear, for his 2012 film Barbara, which starred Nina Haas as an East German doctor constantly monitored by the Stasi, the secret police. His new film, Phoenix, also stars Haas, this time as a Jewish ex-nightclub singer who survived a Nazi concentration camp despite being shot in the face. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The tall, blonde German actress Nina Haas is one of the world's most riveting screen presences. I've heard she's wonderful on stage, too, and she's an opera singer. Haas had a small but intense part as a devoted colleague of Philip Seymour Hoffman in A Most Wanted Man, but her best-received performance was as a persecuted East German doctor in the 2012 film Barbara, directed by Christian Petzold. She unites with Petzold for the sixth time in the morbidly romantic drama Phoenix as Nellie Lenz, a former nightclub singer and concentration camp survivor. At the start of the film, she returns to a rubbled post-war Berlin, her face mutilated by a bullet meant to kill her, in search of her non-Jewish husband, Johnny. The movie's running musical motif is Kurt Weill's yearning Speak Low, lyrics by Ogden Nash. Speak low when you speak love. Our summer day withers away too soon, too soon. It's thumbed by a bass in the opening scene when her Jewish friend Lena drives Nellie, heavily bandaged, through a checkpoint manned by Americans on the German border, and an officer demands to see her face. We don't see it, but his shamefully murmured apology tells us much. In Berlin, a plastic surgeon does a remarkable job. She emerges very beautiful, but she's not, in her own mind, Nellie, physically or spiritually. Though Lena insists that Johnny gave her up to the Nazis to save his own life, Nellie is sure that Johnny will bring her back to her old self. She finds him quickly, bussing tables in the American sector, but he doesn't recognize her. He's sure his wife is dead. He does, though, regard this woman as a godsend. He thinks she looks enough like his wife to be able, with the right clothes and hair and walk and way of speaking, to pass herself off as Nellie and collect Nellie's substantial inheritance. And the dazed Nellie allows him to coach her. She clearly wants to tell him who she really is, but also to wait for him to figure it out. The comparisons to Vertigo, where James Stewart dressed and molded Kim Novak into the image of a lost love, are inevitable, and director Petzold's style in this film and others owes something to Hitchcock. But this is, of course, a reverse angle on Vertigo, a female ghost from a massacred people in search of her past. The question is, will she rise from the ashes? Phoenix is potent, permeated with pain, though sometimes frustrating in Johnny's obtuseness. But Ronald Zerfeld, who acted opposite Haas and Barbara, is extraordinary. He looks a bit here like Oliver Reed, brutish, but with a softness you think must be in there somewhere. You know if he'd stop conniving and really look at Nellie, he'd see her. But he doesn't want to look. Phoenix is all Nina Haas, though. She's different than I've seen her, the opposite of self-possessed. She seems disconnected from her own body. She resembles Jean Moreau here, with a downturned mouth and thick underlip, and with dark bags under her eyes. But those eyes shine with a sort of glassy hope. It's heartbreaking when Johnny tells her that her walk is all wrong, that she's nothing like Nellie, and can't pull it off. What makes Phoenix finally so devastating is that it's not Johnny who needs to see her. It's she who needs to see what he is and find her place in this ravaged post-war world.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
Speak low when you speak low. Our summer day withers away. Too soon, speak low. When you speak low, our moment is swift, like ships adrift. We're swept apart too soon. Speak low, darling, speak low. Love is a spark lost in the dark. Too soon, too soon, I fear, wherever I go, that tomorrow is near, tomorrow is here, and always too soon.
On Monday's show, Terry speaks with filmmaker and comic Bobcat Goldthwait and his friend, comedian Barry Crimmins. Goldthwait's new documentary is about Crimmins, who founded two influential comedy clubs in Boston. Crimmins was sexually abused as a child and later made it his mission to track down pedophiles operating in internet chat rooms. Hope you can join us then. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.